Good morning. Welcome to 1 Corinthians. If we're going to pray in just a second. If you want to start making notes in your 1 Corinthians book and you haven't yet bought it, Leonie is still there by the table. If you want to run quickly and get a book, you can. We're going to start praying, and I wonder, why not turn to your neighbour and tell them something that you have been praying from 1 Corinthians as you've been reading it through and preparing. Tell them what that was, and then pray those things together. Please go. Good. You should have a handout, and you'll see the first exercise, the first box we're going to do is going to be tell each other something. I guess you'll have noticed this is a church with a lot of problems. So we're going to, first of all, just sort of maybe in bigger groups than you just prayed, maybe threes, if you can cope with that, with the chairs, make a list of the problems, but then can you separate out the symptoms from the root causes? So there's lots and lots of problems, but which ones seem to be most important? Which one seems to be causing the other ones? And then if you get time left, you can go for what solutions Paul gives. I think, again, there's multiple solutions that Paul offers. Which ones have you seen? So if you get into groups three or four, and just without discussing them, fairly quickly make lists of those things. That'd be great. Thank you. Shall we make something of a list? So a list of problems. We can have just single word and I'll scribble them down. So I've got a list ready.
Divisions.
What was the other one?
Incest.
Divisions, incest, no resurrection.
Lawsuits.
Sorry, Risha.
Puffed up.
Disorderly worship.
Disorderly worship.
Boasting in gifts.
Boasting. Just in gifts. Yep. We might be able to keep that list going for a while. Yep. Good. Yep. Marriage. In several ways. Confused about that.
Prostitution.
Lawsuits. Yep. Food for idols. Individualism. Immaturity. It's a good list. Anything missing?
Not recognizing Paul.
Yeah, so something, and it'll be much bigger in 2 Corinthians than it a couple of years later, but yes, sort of Paul's authority, something about that. Okay, that's a very good list. Now, that was the easy bit. Any idea which ones you think are sort of root causes? What did each group reckon on that?
We reckoned that a lot of them were because rooted in the culture, I guess, was our central theme.
Rooted in the culture.
And that means they like what looks good, not what is good.
Yeah. So therefore, very into what looks good to their culture. Yeah, thank you. That's a very good suggestion. Stephen. Pride. Yeah. So you could put a load of things behind pride, couldn't you, that it develop out of that? Thank you. Any other? Say again? Well, Stephen thinks it's a root cause.
Yeah. Well, that's
the question that we're discussing, yeah. And I guess then we could discuss between Stephen and Jeremy which one is a bigger root cause. Is it the culture pressing in on them from outside, or is it their pride that then goes to the culture to get things to be proud about? That's exactly the discussion. Yeah. Any other contenders for? Say again, worldliness. So not a specifically Corinthian culture one, but just general. Yeah. So worldliness. Yeah, so just a lack of understanding. Yeah. And when you say the gospel, do you mean anything in particular?
What does it mean to be included in the kingdom already? And how does living as a citizen of the kingdom look?
Thank you. So lack of understanding of the gospel, and you said particularly, so sort of kingdom already. So there's a time element there, isn't there, as well? Yeah, Simpa, you were agreeing.
Not boasting in the cross.
So, okay, so instead of kingdom already, you're going with cross. Yeah, thank you. When does the resurrection happen? So that's time again, but then, or separate option, what is the resurrection? Yeah. Thank you. Okay, that's very good. And then solutions. What did we notice Paul doing? Or did we not get that far?
Gospel and the cross.
The gospel and the cross, or the gospel is the cross?
Gospel of the cross.
Thank you. Yeah.
He corrects the misunderstanding of things. So
yeah.
Misunderstanding about the resurrection.
Yeah. So there are a number of places where he's just patiently correcting ideas they've got wrong. So so correcting those misunderstandings. Thank you. Someone over here was. No, Mr. Chance, come back. Yes. So at least twice, imitate me. Yeah.
The notion of one body, imitate one another.
One body comes up. Thank you very much. Yeah, comes up in several different places, particularly in chapter 12, but in, yeah. Thank you. Any other?
Said love.
Love, yeah. Yeah. Particularly chapter 13, chapter 16. Yeah.
Some places it gives sort of specific instructions about how to deal with specific things. So, sexual immorality tells to flee in relation to sort of the incest type thing, sort of like cut them off.
So there's a reasonable number of commands. Just do this. Your problem would be fixed if you did this. Flee from that. Kick out the person living in incest. Yeah.
Sticking to what you were originally told.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Stick.
No, that's
yeah, so chapter 15, the things of first importance that were handed on to you, so that those with two-year memories, stick would be much more like Colossians, wouldn't it? That would be a stick with what? Thank you. And obviously, if we had time, we'd see if we could match our solutions to our root causes and see if that would help us get to what's the book kind of mostly trying to do. And that's maybe a little bit difficult, isn't it? So Gospel of the Cross, correct their mindset, model to imitate, one body, love, commands, and stick against culture, pride, worldliness. I guess lack of understanding of the gospel, we'd draw the lines most easily to what we just said. But if our root cause problem isn't matching what we think is the biggest thing Paul is saying, then we've probably got at least one of those two things not quite in the right place. Good. Okay, that's excellent. One more gathering information exercise. There are now, I don't know, 49 of us, 48 of us. Does that work mathematically? How many 16s in 48?
Three.
Does that actually work perfectly? That's great. So in threes, you have a chapter each. Okay, chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 16. You need to concentrate for the next 5 seconds or it will be frustrating. So we're going to number off by chapter, okay? So here are the first three, and one of them is going to say the number...
One.
Very good.
Two.
Three.
Four.
Five.
Six.
Seven. Eight.
You have to remember what number you said as well. You guys are pairs on the very back row, because I can't count. Good. So, sorry, I'll tell you the question now. Everyone know their number? The question is this. What do we learn about the situation in Corinth from reading this chapter? And by situate, this is a different question from what's their problem that might relate. Where do they live? What kind of people are they? What's going on around them? Background information. What are we being told in the letter about the situation in which they're living, to which this letter was written in your chapter? Does that make sense? Some chapters have more than others. Can I give you 1 minute more to distill what you've said into the information that the rest of us need to have from your chapter? Okay, we're ready to have a go at that. So you'll need to face the group. Do we want people to stand up? Would that be helpful? Spokesperson can stand up, face the group, and give us what we need to know from each chapter. And again, some chapters may have more to tell us than others. Chapter 1.
They are Christian.
Hey.
Although there's a lot of divisions, quarrelling, they've had access to great teachers, but there's division over that. That seems to be an issue about how they view those teachers. Then we learn they're mostly from humble backgrounds, but they like impressiveness. And they're in a culture in Corinth which loves wisdom and impressive.
Thank you. Everyone here? So, unsurprisingly, chapter 1, very, very important in terms of backgrounds. So, in particular, 126, 127, we are told what they were like before they were Christians, what kind of people they are. And also in the chapter, we're told what their city likes. Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom. And we get these major divisions and factions introduced. Thank you very much. Chapter 2.
I think ours is a bit shorter. They appear to be ashamed of the cross because they prize worldly wisdom.
Thank you. Which ties in very well, doesn't it? Brilliant. Chapter 3.
Quite similar. So they're immature, so they follow their leaders and worldly wisdom, and they focus on now rather than eternity.
Immature. That's fine. I'll repeat. Immature, focused on worldly wisdom and following leaders, and focused on now rather than later. But immature, so 3 verse 1 is the shock, I think. Not spiritual people, but people of the flesh as infants. Thank you. Chapter 4.
Yeah. They seem to have got everything the wrong way around. So they are puffed up looking after following worldly leaders, where they should be thinking about Christ and what he did on the cross. They think that they are rich and well-placed, whereas in fact Paul's going to show that they are the reverse. They don't get the idea that being a Christian is all about following the cross, which is what the apostles have to do, and they are in a terribly difficult situation in contrast to the Corinthians. They don't follow adequately the fact that Paul is the founder of their church. They don't possibly give him enough, and they seem to be all about talking as opposed to doing things.
Thank you very much. And in particular, 4 verse 8 is a very important verse, slightly puzzling verse to put with what we heard from chapter 1. So they are nothings who think they are kings. Very interesting. Great, thank you. Chapter 5. Now you're going to have to face mainly that way. Yeah.
So in chapter 5, the big theme is that there is an extreme form of sexual immorality amongst the people, but that also it's tolerated within the community. And this is having a sort of multiplying effect. So verse 6 to 8, you get this image of leaven. But then Paul is advocating that this really needs to finish.
Thank you. And 5 verse 1 is particularly interesting because this form of sexual immorality is one that is worse than their pagan culture around them. So again, we were talking earlier about the effect of Corinth around them. Here's at least one example where they're going beyond Corinth in what they do. Thank you. Chapter 6.
So they're very litigious. Like, they want to go to Corinth secular courts to deal with even very petty grievances, rather than either bearing the wrong or sorting this out within the church. And then there's also the prostitution in Corinth,
thank you. And I just want to add 6 verse 9 and 10. Such were some of you. So here's the list of the kind of lifestyle a number of them were living before becoming Christians. Thank you very much. chapter 7.
So this seems to be about anxiety and confusion, about the place of both sex in marriage and roles within marriage and non-marriage relationships. There seems to be some need to talk against a prescription in terms of behaviour and roles, where there's some confusion about status in life, about whether you're a Jew, then a Christian, or a slave, then a Christian. And Paul nuances that, and verse 35 seems to be the aim that to promote good order and secure their undivided devotion.
Thank you very much. Very, very helpful. So, quite a few both ands in there. So they've both got a problem about marriage and about the place of sex within marriage, both those things. And issue about singleness as well as marriage. We could throw divorce in as well. We could throw in that some of them have unbelieving husbands. So again, this is a young church where people are becoming Christians, where it hasn't been entire families becoming Christians, and so there's mixed marriages. And then absolutely also good for the background, the issue of slavery and the issue of Jew and Gentile. So this is a church that combines Jewish people and Gentile people, slave people and free people. Thank you. Chapter 8.
So chapter 8 seems to be about food, and food in particular that is being offered to idols. Some in the church think it's okay to eat it, some don't. And the problem is that the knowledgeable ones who know it's okay are not building up the weaker ones who are worried about it.
Thank you very much. Don't hear that? Food sacrifice to idols seems to be a big issue. Some are pro eating it, some are against eating it, and some are being caused to fall away by it. There's more to say in chapter 8, but we'll get there. That's great. Chapter 9. Thank you. So an extended conversation about Paul and his rights and freedoms. We learn a bit more about Paul's role at their church and whether he gets paid or not by them. But Abby is suggesting that's part of a bigger discussion about rights and freedoms. Yeah, thank you. Chapter 10. Thank you. Very helpful. So some of them are idolaters, or at least at severe risk of idolatry. Others who are not idolaters, so again, we are, I think, beginning to see on some of these issues, it's not monochrome. There's two groups. Some who are not idolaters, but are using their freedom in a way that would lead others into idolatry. I think putting 8 and 10 together, we could say, you know, they clearly, a lot of them have come from pagan idol worshipping backgrounds and are still embedded in those sort of social structures, and they're trying to navigate life as a Christian in a pagan city where they used to be pagans. So a lot of that is coming through. Great, thank you. Chapter 11. Thank you. Someone here, so men and women, the difference between men and women, and how you mark that in church in particular, and also the Lord's Supper. Again, we've picked up already slave and free, but there appear to be some people rich enough to have the picnic that they can get drunk at church before the others have finished work and arrived yet. So you've got a very marked social division in terms of who's there at church. Thank you. Chapter 12. Thank you. Yep, they love spiritual gifts, lots of spiritual gifts going on, but they're uninformed about them, 12 verse 1. And then just to confirm what we've seen already, 12 verse 2, when you were pagans. So again, looks like a majority Gentile pagan background church. And I think the suggestion there is that they were into pagan spiritual practices beforehand, and that's part of what's coming across into how they use their gifts now. Thank you. Chapter 13.
So this seems to back up that they are really after knowledge and spiritual progress. They're clearly not loving each other's events, and that more efforts are being divided perhaps one after.
Yeah, thank you very much. And chapter 14.
Yes, similarly, chapter 14 is about tongues, prophecy, and orderly worship, and they seem more focused on their own status than in loving and supporting each other.
Yeah. Thank you. And in 14, you get that the discussion about gifts is actually mainly focused on tongues. That's the thing they're particularly interested in. And you get, we said earlier, the sort of sense of their meetings being at times disorderly. Simpe, go on.
Just a little bit of a plea there. I don't know if we've mentioned worship twice there. If that's only in the title, worship isn't actually mentioned in the chapter. So you were right mentioning the meeting, but it's not.
Okay, Simpo will twitch if you use the word worship to mean church meeting. Every time you say it, you'll see him do that. Yeah, very good. Thank you. 15.
15, I think, is a companion to chapter 1. But in 15, they are confused about the resurrection, and some don't seem to believe it's happened, which means they're confused about their own resurrection and what continuity. That leads them to a fear of missing out and a you only live once attitude, rather than understanding that they actually live twice.
Thank you.
That's right.
Maybe there was something on that. I think maybe for the first time you get this sense that they are about life now and not missing out. That seems to come across. And also something about bodies, that their discussion of what it means to be spiritual, they seem to be a little bit weird about bodies, which again, maybe we'd see now reaching back into the rest of the book, particularly chapter 7, chapter 6. Thank you. Chapter 16. Thank you very much. So bigger body, but this time we mean not just in Corinth, we mean global Christians. And actually you see signs of that. We might see this afternoon in our Bible study this afternoon. But yeah, that's right, absolutely. Thank you very much indeed. That is very helpful. Last for now discussion with your neighbour. Having run through a load of that background, how similar to London and St. Helens do we feel this church and this city of Corinth is, now that we've laid all that out, with your neighbour or in those threes again? Okay, look back around this way. I'm not going to get detailed feedback on that. But I wonder if I could try and collect the tone and the mood on that. So how similar to London church scene and St. Helens do we think Corinth is? What's the kind of mood and tone?
Very similar.
Is that general? Are we going on that? Yeah.
We thought individualistic.
Individualistic.
Culture driven.
Pagan. Wisdom.
Pride.
The stuff they think about sex is very similar to what's kicking around in London and London church scene.
Richard.
we thought one of the exciting, one of the scary things is that if we really are marinated in our own culture, then we won't spot it.
Yeah.
So we need to be very careful as we go through it to say what's this saying.
And that may be one of the effects of the studies week by week, is to realise things we'd not seen before about our own culture. If we're marinated in our own culture, we won't see the similarities. Thank you. And Rachel?
Just to be a slightly dissenting voice.
No.
I feel like that is true, everything you said. The issues that they face because of their idolatry are going to be issues that we face.
Thank you. Thank you. So two dangers there. So there are strong similarities. I think we're agreeing, but not in every single case. I think there's two dangers. There's a danger of totality transfer. We see something that looks similar to us, and we read ourselves back in. And they must be exactly like us because they're similar to us. That may not always be true. Or where they're different, we may miss applications. So food offered to idols, oh, I don't do that, we think. Though actually, a number of people in your group may do, because we are from a world city and a world cultures, and it may be that you think you don't sacrifice food to idols, but there may actually be an idol in the side of their parents' house that they are required to sacrifice food to. So again, so be cautious, assuming where there isn't. Thank you. We'll take one or two more. Richard. Thank you. I'm not aware currently of any man who has his father's wife in St. Helens. I'm not saying it would be impossible, but currently I'm not aware of that. Yeah. Thank you. People here or not here? So three more examples of, just writing one of them you need, write down for later. Three more examples of how we may not be identical. So are our status divisions the same as theirs? Do we have a better mix socially? I think they had a mix. It was how they were dealing with those. We might want to think about those food sacrifice to idol suggestions. What was your third one? Sorry, thank you. And divisions, they were in a particular historical context of the apostles are still alive. So Paul, Cephas, Apollos may not be identical to competing church leaders today. Yeah. Thank you. We will take one more here and then move on. Thank you. I'll repeat across. So tongues is an interesting example. In the wider London church scene, you can find churches that overemphasize the gift of tongues in ways that are very, very similar to Corinth. But at St. Helens, we don't do that in our public meetings. But we potentially emphasize some gifts. Now, it's tricky because chapter 14, I think, says you should emphasize word gifts in your public meetings. Instead of tongues. But that doesn't mean that we are pat on the back, well done us for being correct on gifts, because it may be that actually we are overvaluing people with word gifts, but you might need to think which chapter you're going to deal with that. might be that you want to deal with that strongly in chapter 12, so that chapter 14 you can stick with prioritised word gifts, because you've already kicked people in the head who think they're more important because they have word gifts in chapter 12. So yeah, thank you. That we're capable of their problem, but expressed in a different way. Yeah, excellent. In general, though, I hope you are looking forward to 1 Corinthians. I think again and again and again, we're going to find the step between them and us is not difficult to make with our groups. We're going to find that people come having seen the ways this would impact their lives, seen the way this might be challenging for us at St. Helens or for them in how they interact with non-Christians. So that is exciting. Good. Let me take you through some material on page 1 of the handouts. The first box is just to piece together from 1 and 2 Corinthians what is going on in Paul's relationship with the Corinthians. So this is from the New Bible Dictionary, but is very largely agreed universally. So Paul visits them at least twice, with a third visit planned. So the first time he goes to evangelize them as a city without the gospel, and he is there for a year and a half, spends a very long time there. There are Ephesus, he spends an equivalent amount of time, but other than that, this is one of the places he focuses most. He is teaching, he is discipling them, he is the one who brought them the gospel first. And then he writes a letter that we no longer have. So if you look at chapter 5, verse 9, Paul is referring in 1 Corinthians to a letter that he wrote to them previously. And clearly it was a letter about problems at least to do with sexual immorality and how to respond to sexually immoral Christians. And it looks like they have misunderstood what he meant. So it's clearly he said something like, don't have anything to do with sexually immoral Christians. And they've misunderstood that to mean don't relate to sexually immoral people at all. And that letter we have lost. We no longer have it. And that is no particular problem for the authority of the Bible or our understanding of Scripture. There are lots of letters the apostles wrote that we no longer have. The letter to the Laodiceans that Paul says in Colossians there to swap. That's not a problem. God has kept for us the letters we need. I think in terms of process, it was probably a bit of a telling off, and the Corinthians quietly put it in the bin. And when the other churches came around saying, have you got any letters of Paul we can copy and take home? They said, yes, take this one and not this one. I think it's probably what happened. Then after letter A, there is a sort of busy period when Paul is probably in Ephesus, which you'll see on the map is just the other side of the sea from Corinth, and people are shuttling backwards and forwards, possibly reflecting the divisions in Corinth that, you know, you send somebody to go and talk to Paul. If you don't like what's coming back, then you send your representative to go and talk to Paul. So Chloe's people have come with a report. The church, in some sort of gathered way, have written, 7 verse 1, now concerning the matters about which you wrote. And at the very end of the letter, Paul makes clear that he's had reports and a visit from Stephanus, Fortunatus, and Achaicus, who've been telling him stuff. So they've been busy in the time in between. And when Paul thinks he has clear what's going on, he then writes the letter that we have here. So that's important background for what we've got. There's been at least one letter before. He has a long track record, probably 3 or 4 years of interactions with them, of which a year and a half was spent physically present with them. You can see in 1 Corinthians that there is a visit coming. So chapter 4, verse 19, you might want to add on to the handout. I will come to you soon, if the Lord wills, and I will find out not the talk of these arrogant people, but their power. So he's threatening to come and sort things out for them. And in fact, 1 Corinthians is designed to prepare the way for that visit. So the visit will be not so troublesome when it actually happens. Then when you pick up chapter 1 of 2 Corinthians, you can see that that visit was delayed. And they are cross about that. and Paul has to spend some time explaining why he didn't come and what that does or doesn't mean. But then clearly there was a visit, and that it was painful. There's some dispute about which order all that happens in, but 2 verse 1 of 2 Corinthians, I made up my mind not to make another painful visit to you, or 1 verse 23, it was to spare you that I refrained from coming again to Corinth. So let me just clarify the order there. There's a visit that was painful and they found hard, followed by an absence of visit after that, a non-visit, and then the letter of 2 Corinthians. Sorry, so there's visit B and there is non-visit C. And then he writes 2 Corinthians sometime later. And things have clearly moved on by 2 Corinthians, and we'll say something about that in a second. Any questions on that layout of events? Great. It's the visits, I think, get particularly confusing. In terms of their situation, just a brief word on what we can know from outside of the Bible. So there is a map. I think it's reasonable to assume that those receiving this letter knew where they were geographically. There is also there are some dates for you there. So the city was an important Greek city, but it was destroyed by the Romans in 146 BC and was not important then for a considerable period of time, until about 100 years later it was refounded as a Roman colony, in particular, apparently, using freed slaves to refound the city, which might or might not be important for some of the discussions in the letter. I think, again, it's reasonable to take geographically and what we know that it is in a good trading point. So if you look at the map, you can see that Greece narrows down to almost nothing at the point where Corinth is. And so your choice, if you were trading from anywhere east of Greece towards anywhere west of Greece, you had a choice of traveling around the bottom of Greece, which would have taken an enormously long time, where there were places your ship could be wrecked and where you would be in danger, or you could unload your cargo on one side of the little bit of land, carry it across to the other side and put it on a different ship where you could pay tax to the Corinthians for the privilege of doing that. So Corinth, and then you'd have a nice safe inland water and then a short hop across to Italy the other side. So for that reason, Corinth is a very good place to put a market, so you can bring goods in from both directions and trade them directly in Corinth. It's a meeting point of ideas, trade routes, and it's a place of wealth. But having said that, we should be very cautious about, particularly if you're going to read commentaries on 1 Corinthians, very cautious about what people say they can know from sources outside the Bible. We have perhaps 1% survival of the ancient world. We know 1% of how they lived and what they did and what it was like to live there. So just because we have data on Corinth, we don't know that that data is typical data for Corinth. We might have just dug up a very unusual household or a very unusual sort of business or temple. And in general, it's hard to say what's typical, hard to say how Corinth differs from other places if we don't know everything about Corinth and those other places. So we should have a degree of humility about that. And in particular, we might have data about one point in time across a very large historical period. So commentaries are very fond of the verb to Corinthianize. Do you know about this? So there is a verb to Corinthianize, and it's a negative verb. It's to do with sexual immorality. So if you say someone is a bit Corinthian, you mean they're a bit licentious sexually. But that verb relates to the city that was destroyed in 146 BC. That verb relates to the Greek culture of the Greek city, which was destroyed and didn't exist for 100 years and is another 80 years from when it's refounded to when Paul is writing this letter. So does that verb still mean in the Corinth Paul writes to what it meant in the Greek city? Possibly. How long will the reputation of Las Vegas last after Las Vegas is destroyed? How many hundreds of years later will we still be using that as a byword for Sin City? So we just need to be cautious about things like that. And certainly we don't want to say that no one could understand the letter of 1 Corinthians until the right scholar discovered the right thing in 2018. And we don't want to give greater weight to extra-biblical material than material that the Lord God has decided to include for us, in particular in the book of Acts and the book of 2 Corinthians. Those are going to be the best places to go for what we really need to know. What we need is in the Bible. And if you think of what we did going through chapters 1 to 16, there's an enormous amount of material just in the letter itself, let alone in Acts and 2 Corinthians. Let me give you two areas where I think the extra-biblical material is particularly helpful, though I think we do need to keep those cautions. One is about food sacrifice to idols. Again, that is clearly an issue that Paul expects them to understand what's going on. They're expected to have background knowledge that most of the people in your group won't have. And in particular, I think it's helpful to reconstruct that there are a variety of circumstances in which this food was being eaten. That helps, because Paul seems to be okay with it in some parts of chapters 8 to 10 and thoroughly opposed to it in other bits of chapter 8 to 10. I think it's helpful to know, and this is archaeology mainly, that there is the temple itself where the animal is being sacrificed. There is a sort of temple-located dining room where you can eat the food, but within the temple precincts and environment. And that if you are in a trade guild, you probably go for your trade hall meal in the temple. So the food is sacrificed upstairs, comes downstairs for you to eat it, but very much in a temple environment. And then there are the meat markets around about, and then the meat appearing in private homes, but it's the same meat. So Billy the goat is sacrificed in the temple. He comes downstairs to be eaten in the temple dining room. And then anything that's left over goes out into the marketplace where your next door neighbour buys it and feeds it to you. And we've got a variety of situations. Similarly, chapter 11, it's probably helpful to know that there is a serious women's liberation movement going on at the time. And that relates to hair in particular. And that there's a general cultural movement towards women's property rights, women's education, women's voice in public debate, and that those are live issues. Again, we still want the Bible to tell us, we want Paul to tell us what he's saying, what it means, but it may be helpful to know that that's going on as the wider context. Very briefly from Acts 18, I think particularly helpful in Acts 18 is the Jewish and Gentile mix. Sosthenes, who writes the letter, may be the same Sosthenes who tried to stamp out the church, who is a synagogue leader who loses a court case and gets beaten up. It'd be quite nice to think he might be the Christian who's then writing the letter with Paul. We don't know that for certain. That's where we learn the year and a half of steady preaching ministry. And we also learn stuff about Apollos, which is interesting and I think deliberate. So Luke, who knew Paul well, when he's writing the history of Corinth, includes quite a lot of information about a man called Apollos, who you'd think in Acts isn't that important. But when you read 1 Corinthians, you realise why Luke might have thought we need to know some things about Apollos. So don't stop reading where Paul leaves Corinth. There's more data to come. And 2 Corinthians, again, the situation has moved on. We don't want to read 2 Corinthians back into 1 Corinthians and say that is what it's like. But there are positive things. We can see they have repented because of Paul's letter and then his visit. We can see that money has become a bigger, weird problem. And we can see a bigger concern about Paul's apostleship and about whether there are better apostles than Paul, super apostles, and how you can tell what's a good apostle. And some of those things are helpful. Okay, any questions about either of those areas? Yeah, Sue.
Charlie, briefly, the source for the kind of women's political issues in Corinth at that time.
Thank you. Is it Bruce Winter, I think, has written stuff on that, and his sources are various. So Roman and Greek discussions about women and the new women, he would call it, in the Roman Empire at the time. Statues, what people are wearing in statues, what their hair is doing in statues, that kind of stuff. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Excellent. Turn the page. And what I'm going to do now, before the coffee break, which I think is in 10 minutes' time, we'll see how far we get down this page in that time, is give away my thinking on the overview of 1 Corinthians. And one question for you to tell me during the course of today is how much you want me to do this on Tuesday and Thursday this week. So for your studies and your groups, how much do you want me to give away my thinking on what the book is saying and how? And it might be that you think this will help accelerate our studies, get us going on the same page. It might be you think this will give away things that you are looking forward to helping your group discover for themselves. So we won't be able to please every group together, but you might want to tell me what you think. So here's what I think. This is not to say that you're not allowed to disagree with me during the year. So this is to give you as clearly as I can the decisions I've made. I suspect that you will disagree with a number of them at this point. I've taught 1 Corinthians for 3 years with the apprentices. And what I found was that people, as they worked through the letter, changed their view significantly. And in particular, because chapter 15 is such a weighty chapter, that people tended to have very little about the resurrection and to have a very different view of what was going on in the letter before they'd studied chapter 15 compared to what they thought after they'd studied chapter 15. And even though I'm sure you will have done hours and hours of preparation in the entire letter, it might be that at this stage your preparation has been weighted towards the beginning of the letter, and so you might well have a particular view of the letter at this point. And we'll see by the end of the letter whether we're putting it together. So this is my view. My view is that they combine insecurity and boasting, or that their boasting comes out of insecurity. So that is a slightly different judgment from the one that I think a number of us were heading towards in terms of what we're saying about their pride. I think pride can be, or kind of the symptom of pride, can be rooted in insecurity just as much as it can be rooted in overconfidence and too high a view of yourself. And I think in Corinth we have insecurity leading to boasting. We have puffed upness, but it's the puffed upness of the little man who thinks who's not confident, so he makes too big a noise about himself. I think that's closer to what's going on. So let me give you some evidence for that. Chapter 1, verse 26 and 27 and 28 is huge, I think. Not many of you were wise, powerful, noble. You were, in fact, foolish, weak, low, despised, and things that were not. I think that's very important. This collection of Christians who've gathered in the church were unimpressive in a city that valued how impressive you were highly. So they have an insecurity complex. Possibly also there's a moral element to that, chapter 6. This is what some of you were: sexually immoral, idolaters, adulterers, men who practice homosexuality, thieves, greedy, drunkards, revilers, swindlers. Now, some of those are things that would have gone very well in Corinth. So to be an idolater increased your status in Corinth, but possibly some of those other things, they're aware in a Christian world now, particularly with some Jewish Christians in there, that their spiritual track record was not excellent. And their world values 122 signs and wisdom. They value debating. They value sophisticated presentation of material. And we can see this in chapter 2, verse 1, lofty speech and wisdom. And you can see in 11, verse 22, that they're in a world where there are ways of signalling your status. And humiliating those of lower status than yours. And that's what they seem to be doing in their church meetings. You can also see that in chapter 7, in verses 17 to 24. You can see that they are concerned about how Jewish they are or aren't. Should the uncircumcised person seek to become circumcised? And same thing again with slavery. Should the person who is a slave seek their freedom, that again, that appears to be a status thing. So here's my suggestion. They are insecure, and most of them from a low status background, but that they react to that by being puffed up. And we've had that already referred to. I think this is one of the key words in the book. It's there. I've given you all the places where it comes. But in some of them, it is hidden from you. So 4 verse 18, arrogant. 4 verse 19, arrogant is the same word as puffed up. 5 verse 2, arrogant, same word as puffed up. 8 verse 1, we are told it is puffed up. And 13 verse 4, love does not, well, is not arrogant, is not puffed up. I think in general, their PR, you'd say, is that they think they are the best church in the world. That is their self presentation. They think they're the most gifted, wisest, best church in the world. And that comes out in a number of interesting ways. It comes out in their unreality of their boast. 4 verse 8, they say they are rich. They say they've become kings. They say they reign. Again, we might need to talk about quite what that means, but this is their presentation of themselves. They are the royal, reigning, wealthy, rich, blessed church. That's what they think of themselves. It comes out in their divisions. And here's where I think the insecurity thing helps. Their divisions are about making it clear how good they are. So they actually would be surprised, maybe they should have just thought about it for 5 seconds, but they'd be surprised that Paul was negative about their divisions. For them, their divisions are positive. It's about expressing how wise and spiritual they are. And they focus that in particular on the leaders. So they are a good church, the best church, because they have the best leader. And that's why they're so invested in these debates. We follow Apollos because Apollos is wiser, more credible, more spiritually powerful. And that's what makes us the best church and makes us better than the culture around us. Potentially even that's what will give us the evangelistic power in the culture of Corinth. So that's a feature of their puffed upness. 5 verse 2 is perhaps the most astonishing, that they are arrogant, potentially despite their sexual problems. How can you think you're the best church in the world when the person in the pew behind you is sleeping with his father's wife? Again, remember this letter is being read out live to a group where all these people are assembled. So when he says, some of you say, I follow Apollos, there's a group in the room going, yes, in their Apollos t-shirts. But again, as they're saying the incest thing, the bloke is sitting there probably, and you know, I don't know if she's in the room as well, possibly with his father sitting on a different side of the room, so this is fairly explosive. Potentially though, they are arrogant about the fact that they have someone who's sleeping with his father's wife. Potentially there's something about, look how sexually liberated we are, that this guy is able to do that. How secretive are they about their trips to the prostitutes? Potentially that is actually on the notice sheet. Yeah, a group of the lads are going down. If you know, some of us are going to, what's it called, Pizza Union. Some of us are going to the brothel. Which trip do you want to join after the service? Certainly they're puffed up about their knowledge. 8 verse 1, they are very keen to let you know that they possess knowledge, and Paul has to say this knowledge puffs up. That's having an effect on you. And again, we've talked about the gifts. They're very keen on their gifts. And 12 verse 21, those with some of the gifts, the eye is saying to the hand, I have no need of you. So their understanding of how gifted they are is leading them to puff themselves up and say, I don't need the other members of the church family. Though, we mustn't say that they were all like this, because you've also got 12 verse 16. You've got some people at the lower end of the scale, either socially or probably in gifted terms, saying, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body. So it's worth, even as the focus, I think, is on the puffed up, arrogant, pushing themselves people, it's worth always thinking, what would it have been like to be in Corinth and know that you were not excellent? Know that you were not, didn't have the spiritual gifts they valued. Know you didn't have the knowledge and the status they valued. Because both groups are clearly there, even if he's addressing the sort of the group who think they're the best. Let me just get to the end of Puffed Up, and then we'll break for coffee. I think deliberately that the word puffed up occurs in each of Paul's structural divisions. So it's there a lot in chapter 4 at the end of the first structural division, which is to make sure we see that as a big theme. And then he flags it, and often early, in each of the next sections. So 5 verse 2 at the beginning of the section, 5, 6, 7, 8 verse 1 at the beginning of the section, 8, 9, 10, and then in chapter 13, less clearly flagged in 13, but there in the section on the church, 11, 12, 13, 14. So I'd suggest that puffed up is very close to the heart of the book, and the function of lots of the book is to stick a pin in their puffed up balloon, is to deflate their sense of themselves. And Paul will use a variety of kind of irony, tone of voice, mocking in the ways he does that, because they're puffed up and he needs them to come back to reality. And here's my suggestion, is that puffed up is a way of speaking about their main problem, their main root problem. Okay, we're going to pause there and go for coffee. And after coffee, I'll try and defend that a bit more, or try and tell you how I think the whole book shapes up in terms of the answer to that problem. We've got half an hour for coffee. You might like to just look at what's at the very bottom of the timetable, where it says you could read those two documents and sign for Wendy that you've done that. And it might be that 5 minutes over coffee would enable you to go home with a clean conscience in that, and clean hands during the food. Thank you very much.